Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Can my writer, my friend, tell me, the House, and this country that Northern Ireland will always be part of the United Kingdom?
A united Ireland. A realistic prospect or pure fantasy? Inevitable or impossible? Far, far away or on the political horizon?
It's a legitimate political aspiration for people in our country to want to see a united Ireland. That's not where my focus and priority is now. And quite frankly, I don't believe it's where our priority and focus should be.
Listening to the radio, reading the papers and browsing social media, it seems unionists and their allies seem convinced a united Ireland was never farther away or more unrealistic than it is today.
But I am comfortable that in my lifetime, certainly Northern Ireland will be a strong and wonderfully prosperous part of the United Kingdom.
Yet at the same time, nationalists seem to have never been more assertive or confident than they are today.
My colleague Michelle O'Neill becoming for the first time a Sinn Féin First Minister in the North are just indicators of a profound change that's happening in Ireland. And when I say unity is within touching distance, I said in historic terms.
What's the truth of the matter? Or is it impossible to say? Joining me to have a go at this difficult question are political writer, lecturer and commentator David McCann and commentator Owen Poley. You're very welcome to the Bell Tell, gentlemen.
Thank you, Kieran.
Thank you.
David, you are a renowned political scientist. Can you give me an objective analysis? Is a united Ireland possible, inevitable or unattainable?
Well, I think it's always useful to disclose at the start that I am a supporter of Irish unification, just to get that bias out there. But look, if you look at some of the polling data, there is a mixed picture. There is no question, by the way, in every poll that has been done, bar one, apart from the Lord Ashcroft one, the support for the union has been ahead of the pro-unification set. There's no question about that. The issue is that that gap has slightly narrowed. If you take a look at polls that were done probably over a decade ago, the pro-union side would have been consistently touching in the high 50s, nudging towards 60%. That is now down towards the 50%, 48% range. Irish Unity has been, in some polls, they were in the mid-20s. Now some polls have them up toward 40%. Again, still behind the pro-union side, but trending up in some polls. It's flatlining in others, for full disclosure as well. And the other side of this about this is the prevalence of kind of the debate around Irish unity, the conversation, as it's sometimes referred to positively on some side, on the pro-unions, on the pro-unity side, negatively, pejoratively on the pro-union side. There is a growing prominence of the debate. And the reason why we see this is largely it's been pinned down to Brexit. We're seeing newer voices in the debate. So people like, for example, former Lands Party leader Lord Alderdice, who's talked about a trajectory of travel towards Irish unity. You're seeing people in the Alliance Party engage in this debate in a way that they were not doing a number of years ago. Whether this leads to unity remains to be seen, but there is no question support for the union has come trended down in Northern Ireland. There are a lot more don't knows in the border poll debate than there was previously, but still nothing's inevitable about it, but definitely the issue has definitely risen up the agenda from where it was in comparison to 10 years ago.
David, from the very beginning, you jumped in and you foresaw my second question that I have written down in front of me. And this is for both people. And I wonder, is an objective, cold, detached analysis possible on this subject? Because I read week in, week out, columns, articles, etc., etc., blogs, tweets. And I mean, I just wonder, are we really reading what people's intellects tell them, or are we reading wishful thinking either way? I mean, would you have an opinion on that, Owen?
Well, I kind of, I see where you're coming from, but I almost kind of reject the premise that it can be a cold sort of logical debate, and that that's what we strive for, because actually, I mean, this is inevitably going to be about emotion and about people's identity, about their sense of belonging, about their political allegiance, and about the very many sort of centuries of history that we've built up together. So there's no way that it can sort of separate out the economic facts and the sort of constitutional minutiae in a way that sets aside those kind of emotional issues, because that wouldn't be an honest way to debate it either. And I mean, the kind of perception that I've had as a unionist, and again, you know, I'm not neutral on this issue. I very much believe that Northern Ireland's future should be within the United Kingdom. But the conversation that David's talked about, and the conversation that so much energy has been expended in getting started, I've felt is more of a debate. And the fact is that, yes, unionists can't be complacent, because there has been a successful attempt to sort of portray this debate as a conversation, particularly after Brexit, and people have become involved. I would say that those people who declare themselves persuadable for a United Ireland are very often completely immersed in UK political culture and UK politics, and that's where their disillusionment or their kind of frustrations with intra-UK politics have kind of come out in this sort of openness to constitutional debates or whatever. But I don't see that very much as sort of a deep knowledge or kind of consideration of what a Republic of Ireland or what the Republic of Ireland offers, or what an all-Ireland state would mean. I think it comes very much from the space of frustrated people within the kind of British political space.
I find your answer to be very honest, to be honest, because I have put that point to people on this podcast and outside of this podcast, that much of this is emotions, and much of this is what Conor Cruise O'Brien might have described as ancestral voices. And many people are quite determined to say, no, this is all about the logical decision that people will make after looking at all of the data. That's not the way politics works, David, is it?
No. In fact, actually, Leo Varadkar had a very interesting comment on RT News, his last interview as Taoiseach, where he said, look, we can't boil down the debate on Irish unification to numbers. You know, he referenced Germany. He said, West Germans were not asking how much it was going to cost to unify their country. And he said, there are 4% of GDP, which is the figure quoted in a report last week, which we might get to, is a small price to pay for Irish unity. And that was the view that he outlined.
The Republic would cost the Republic 20 billion euro a year. Do you think that's a realistic figure, and do you think it's affordable if it is?
You know, I have to say, unification should never be about money. You know, I don't think when the Berlin Wall came down, people in West Germany ever considered not unifying their country.
Because they paid a heavy price for it.
Yeah, but I think an economic case can be made that it would cost less, and that we could grow our economy. And economic growth is the best way to generate revenue, of course. But I don't think it should be about that. If you believe in the unification of your country, 3 or 4% of GDP is a small price to pay.
And I totally get what Owen says as well on the pro-union side of that quite often. I think sometimes on the New Ireland side, we make the mistake that the people who are unionists kind of view their Britishness in terms of pounds and pennies. It's not. It's a deep feeling. It's a deep sense of Britishness that you can't put a GDP figure on. And the way I know that is because many people like me feel the same about their Irishness. So I get that. And there is, Arthur Griffith talked about not being Irish people, not being moved by a cold thing like economics, that it was a matter of politics, it's about a matter of feeling. And I do think there is some emotion in that. But however, whilst people, nerds like me and Owen, who are interested in this, maybe are more swayed by the emotional side, there is a section of the electorate in Northern Ireland that genuinely do not get moved by the constitutional debate. It is not their modus operandi. It's not what gets them out of bed in the morning. And there will be some of those people who will make a penny and pounds decision on it. And the key demographics for this electorally and politically are that that group of people will be the one who decides which side, if there ever is a border poll, has a five in front of their total and which one has a four. And that's why both campaigns need to be pitched towards those swing voters, the persuadables.
Owen, I don't want to put you on the spot, but I mean, I'm always interested in this sort of maybe contradiction, as I would see it, between the union as a political concept and unionism as, you know, the interests of a section or of a community. Because I've met Catholics here in Northern Ireland. I've heard them. I've read their opinions. And despite the fact that many of them may feel that they have been discriminated against in the past, even some who've suffered violence, still in all, many of those people have a deep affinity with the UK. It mightn't be draped in a flag, but they have a deep affinity to the UK. And I would think with demographics that those people are absolutely key to the union. I mean, what should unionism do to keep them on board with the union, or at least keep them from voting for a United Ireland?
Well, I absolutely agree with that. And I think you've kind of pinpointed one of unionism's historical failures, which was to sort of go down this line. And it was a line that suited nationalism, that unionism in a sense was a tradition or a culture within the Irish state or the Irish nation, and not a genuine and deeply felt allegiance to the United Kingdom, which involved participating in the UK in terms of its economy, its politics, its culture and society and all these other kinds of things. And I think that kind of cultural unionism has led to many of the problems that we have today. And I think in particular of the Irish Sea border, of the fact that issue brought to prominence in a way that many unionists didn't seem to appreciate or understand. And I think that when unionist parties kind of fall back on this community language, the unionist community, and allow that to be confused with Protestantism or orange culture or all these other kinds of things, then they let themselves down, because although those things are part of it, it should be very, they should be very clear that what they want and what they're pushing, what they're promoting, is a full participation in the United Kingdom. And they should also be looking to participate more fully, I think, in the politics of the United Kingdom and trying to play a part in the governance of their nation state rather than, you know, playing a bit part role. I mean, that's something that I've argued throughout the years, and I feel that it's something that unionists haven't particularly done well.
Having said that, I mean, it's perfectly understandable that many people might see unionism in cultural terms, in ancestral terms, in heritage terms, and that it might be a much, much deeper thing for many, many people than the union itself. I mean, the union may serve as the vehicle of that culture for many people.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's a multi-layered thing, you know, your sense of belonging, your sense of political allegiance. Of course it is. But when we're sort of defining words, what is unionism? Unionism is wanting to remain part of the United Kingdom. And, you know, we get into sort of strange debates about, can unionists be included, incorporated into an All-Ireland state? And whether they can or they can't be, the main sort of point that I would make in that is, if they do go down that road, what's lost is their unionism, because they're not really going to have a route back to the United Kingdom. That's gone. So in terms of, we're almost using the wrong words to describe a culture or an identity rather than the political project that is unionism.
David, I'll swing across to you, and I mean, I'm going to ask a very similar question, I suppose. You know, if every nominal Catholic, every small N nationalist, everyone from a culturally Irish background or ancestry was in fact in favour of a United Ireland, well, then we would be in a United Ireland already.
Yeah, but I think that Northern Ireland has changed. I think these things aren't as binary as they used to be. And this idea that you grew up in a certain background and therefore you skew a certain way, I just think doesn't apply to the same extent. I think it applies to some extent, but just not to the same extent that it maybe did 30, 40, 50 or 60 years ago. The constitutional argument, I think, that will prevail is the one that gets that. You know, constitutional arguments that get the future trends. So they're not looking at where things are today. They're thinking 10, 15 years down the line, and they're saying, great, we're going to position ourselves there. I think we'll be the ones who essentially will get a referendum or stop a referendum in unionism's case, and then go on to win it. And I think that's essentially the group that understands that, because like the old Northern Ireland as we knew it is gone. It's never coming back. And I don't mean that in terms of the old unionist government. I mean in terms of the old kind of political debates. I think this third force, this third bloc, this communal bloc, I think has grown. It was, and I don't mean just the Alliance Party. If you take a look at the Greens, they're much more of a prevalent force. Even in defeat, they're much more of a prevalent force in Northern Ireland than they were previously. I think when you see parties like People for Profit as well rejecting the label of nationalism, whilst they do support a United Ireland, they reject the label of nationalism. So again, you have to be able to appeal to those people as well. And I think the group that understands the constitutional campaign, that understands the Alliance voter, the Green voter, those people best, and can make their pitch accordingly, will be the constitutional viewpoint that will, I think, go on to either secure the union or either unite Ireland.
But there's a challenge in that, David, is there not? I mean, beyond, you know, trying to convert, I mean, and I've, you know, put the point of pro-union Catholics to Owen, but for people in favour of United Ireland, beyond converting people from a unionist background, you know, first of all, mm-hmm. you'd have to woo a lot of non-unionist people to vote for United Ireland on the day. For example, I mean, we have people who really dislike Sinn Féin. There's a lot of those people. Sure. We have people with right-wing views who might look at immigration in the Republic. People have mentioned this to me saying, no, I'm not sure about that. There are certain sections of socialism who have no interest in being part of this very neoliberal state. And we have simply people who have bought into Northern Ireland who are assimilated culturally and politically to the state that they have always lived in, which is not an entire surprise. So, I mean, Sinn Féin and others have a real battle on their hands even there.
Well, they do and they don't. Look, I think that, look, because I think this is, you know, Owen talked about Protestantism and unionism being so fused together. I always think the terms like socialist republic are misguided. A border poll and a United Ireland can no more guarantee you a socialist republic than anyone on the right can guarantee a capitalist one. That's for a future Irish government to decide whether the country goes in a socialist direction or not. That's for general elections to decide. A constitution can't dictate that for you about whether your country is socialist, capitalist, or is somewhere in between or whatever. I think debates around the economy slightly miss the point about Irish unity. The key thing for Irish unity is the increase in Northern Ireland's decision-making capacity within a sovereign parliament. And that unquestionably grows substantially, even more in a united Irish parliament than it does in the House of Commons. And that's just a statistical, will always be a statistical fact. We are 1.9 million of 63 million people, 2% of the House of Commons. Northern Ireland would be around 26, 27% of Dáil Éireann. And it's that decision-making capacity, your ability to influence decisions with your vote becoming more powerful, with TDs who can actually do more than the Northern Ireland MPs can. Kind of goes back to, it's using Owen's argument there about unionism being part of the governance of the nation state. I think there's actually something within nationalism that can actually take that argument and make a proactive case. But I think this talk about whether it'll be a socialist republic, capitalist republic, I think it misses the point.
Oh, and I'd say now you haven't been swung by David's offer of some political power or increased political power.
No, I mean, I don't think so. I think that Northern Ireland has played sort of an outsized role in many aspects of UK life, and it can play an outsized role in politics as well. We've actually seen some national politicians from a Northern Ireland background as well. Think about the likes of Kate Hoey or Brian McWhinney or whatever. And I think from the unionist perspective, the ace card that we hold is that we already live in a prosperous, stable, relatively free UK, while the merits of the independent All-Ireland state that David's talking about are all theoretical, in essence. And as you've pointed out, there is an immense amount of buy-in, actually, to Northern Ireland as it is currently, surprisingly enough, due to some of the problems that we've had. But, you know, you look at the kind of Northern Ireland Life and Times surveys that are finding that, you know, up to, is it over 80%, sort of, I think maybe 83% of people definitely or probably felt a sense of belonging to Northern Ireland. That's an extraordinary figure, given that it's a place whose existence really has been attacked since its inception. Although it's important to acknowledge that this is a legitimate debate, it's also important to acknowledge that we're being invited to kind of take a step into the dark, where there's, you know, possible social instability, unrest, possibly even violence, but at least at the very best, great uncertainty about what an All-Ireland state would mean. And people aren't going to just strip that away in order to make a completely kind of pounds and pence decision, because that's important too. And that was one of the things that very many people brought up in Brexit. Actually, some of the people who are now saying that they're persuadable in this debate. And that's almost like an irony to my mind.
David, you're an expert on referenda, and Owen, you've brought up Brexit. People keep telling me, you need to have everything worked out beforehand, and then you vote on the deal. That is not the way I ever imagined a referendum. I assumed it'd be a referendum on the principle. I was around at the time of the Good Friday Agreement, and then people would work it out after. The Brexit is an amazing point, because people say we need to avoid the disaster of Brexit. But of course, if you were for Brexit, it's not a disaster, it's great. So, I mean, when people say, especially in the Republic, to avoid the disaster of Brexit, what the disaster of Brexit they mean is that people actually voted for Brexit. So psychologically, I'm wondering what's happening there. I mean, I just wonder, David, the point about goalposts, and this has been, and I'll bring you on to the referenda and the changing way people are imagining it. I mean, first of all, Good Friday Agreement was 50% plus one. Then people started talking about a supermajority. Then people started talking about, okay, we'd need to have everything worked out, you know, down to the last traffic cone. We need to know what we're voting on. And then people brought in, you know, the costs, and we need to know the exact costs. And people now seem to say, the latest one is, well, Northern Ireland would have to be completely reconciled. I mean, if these goalposts keep moving, I mean, they'll be in the Isle of Man by the time we ever get anywhere. So, I mean, how do referenda normally work?
Well, you know, Isle of Man may need to vote yes before the referendum stand at some point at the rate we're going. Look, the Good Friday Agreement is clear. It is a 50% simple majority vote. Although, however, though, whilst I accept that that is a crude way of doing it, it is democracy, but I think the key thing for those of us who want Irish unity, and this goes back to kind of something that Owen has said, is that, look, I think you can lose something and not think the world is over, okay? And the key thing for those on the pro-unity side is, can we, for someone like Owen, who will, if, say, the referendum happens, say it loses, say Irish unification wins 53-47, just say for the sake of argument, someone like Owen doesn't sit there and think that the world's over. Yes, be disappointed. Yes, feel, yes, not be happy with the outcome, but at least not feel like the world has ended. And I think that that is something that we definitely do have control over. I do think that there is definitely something that we do have power over. People are going to have emotion about this. The key thing is about accepting the outcome and having trust in the democratic process. Look, if it's a narrow majority to stay in the UK, look, you have to accept that. If you're a Democrat, you have to accept the outcome. But likewise, if it's the other way around, again, we have to accept that outcome. And just on the detail of the plan, unification's not going to be an event. It's going to be a process. So if there is a vote to leave, it is going to take a good bit of time for Northern Ireland to properly extricate itself from the UK. I always make the point, you know, the Free State was officially created in 1922. It took about 16 years for Southern Ireland to properly extricate itself from the machinery of the United Kingdom. It took 16 years for them to do that. I genuinely don't think that we should be dogmatic about this. I think one of the problems with Brexit was many of the English nationalist wing of Brexit thought Brexit had to be a certain way and had to be done by this time. And that caused, I think, a lot of problems. I think if there had been a more pragmatic approach taken to Brexit and how it was going to be achieved, I think the outcome may be much less painless, a much less painless process. So if unification will be a process, it won't be an event.
Oh, and this debate, this conversation, this podcast perhaps is one that as a unionist perhaps you'd prefer wouldn't be happening. But how do you avoid it? How do you take part in a debate and not take part in the conversation?
Well, as somebody who occasionally appears in the media, it's been almost impossible to absent myself from this conversation because 50% of the time when I'm invited in to talk about something, it seems to be this subject. That I mean, it makes great radio, great podcasts, great TV, I suppose, because it's a high stakes thing. But I do believe that unionism needs to put more energy into talking about what it wants, what its aspirations are, how it would like to sort of shape the United Kingdom in a way that gives Northern Ireland more of a say, in a way that gives us, you know, a positive sort of feeling about the future, and you know, just looks more at that kind of constitutional option, at what that offers. So I think you know, unionists and unionist parties have a duty upon them to kind of change the conversation and get their own conversation going, because that's what's important to us, rather than discussing, you know, the minutiae of a theoretical All-Ireland state at some point.
Absolutely. But I think, as Alex Keane has mentioned many times, unionism has failed sort of to get out in front and to be the conversation starters and not be the reactive party.
That kind of comes with the territory to a certain extent of wanting to protect the status quo. And we're all, you know, very much caught up in the idea of change being a merit for change's sake. But very often what you've got has got merits too. And that's where unionism has been making the argument. But it's not as exciting as discussing something that could theoretically happen in a way. But at the same time, it's also got the strength of being here and now, and being certain and being definite. So it's a different type of argument, but at the same time, it's a compelling one too.
David, can I ask you a final question? And there is some debate over whether a referendum would be needed in the Republic of Ireland due to the constitutional commitment that the state has. But sometimes I do wonder, and it's very, very hard to tell the truth of this, but I wonder, could a variety of factors come into play? This new far right, the immigrant vote, neoliberalism, cultural concerns, mm-hmm. this kind of Redmondism, neo-unionism, 26 country patriotism, a deep antipathy to Sinn Féin. Could elements of the political world manage to swing a referendum in the South and prevent unity and to make all of this irrelevant?
It could happen. You can never say never. I mean, look, there's been plenty of referenda which have started off in the Republic with large leads. We saw that most recently. Both options in the referendum there started off ahead in the polls. And of course, there was massive swings during the campaign and they ended up being defeated. So look, you know, you can't definitely rule that out. Look, there's no complacency. I often hear the term about, well, sure, the South will vote for unity no matter what. You can't just assume that. You can't just take people for granted. You need to be able to get out there and put a forceful argument forward. And look, the argument in the South is going to have to be a bit different than the argument in the North. You know, we often think about places like Cyprus, where the North voted for unification, the South actually voted against it. Again, it requires both states to vote, to give an affirmative vote for this to be a goer. And that will definitely be something that has to be worked out. You definitely can't take people for granted or just assume an outcome. You have to be able to work and put a compelling case that works in Belfast, but that case also has to work in Kerry as well. It's not enough just to focus on Northern Ireland. You have to win across the Andaman.
David McCann, Owen Pauley, thank you.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.